is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Traumatic brain injuries are a major cause of death and disability in the United States, contributing to about 30% of all injury deaths. Those who survive a brain injury may face short-term effects lasting a few days to disabilities that could last the rest of their lives. Joining us to discuss traumatic brain injuries are University of Cincinnati Division of Neurotrauma Director and Department of Neurosurgery Associate Professor Dr. Norberto Andaluz and UC Department of Neurosurgery Research Associate Professor Dr. Jed Hardings. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jed and Norberto, thank you for being here this afternoon.
Good Thanks morning. A lot for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Jed, tell us, what is a traumatic brain injury?
A traumatic brain injury is any injury caused to the brain by external mechanical force. It can be an object striking the head, or the head striking an object. And it can range in severity from anything from a mild injury like a concussion all the way up to a severe head injury that you might get from, say, a motorcycle accident or a severe fall with your head hitting concrete pavement, for instance.
Now, can even a mild injury be serious, be a serious problem?
Definitely. And this is something that we have come to understand a little bit better in the last few years with all this interest that's been in this magic word now, concussion. It's been really very interesting because in the past, you know, many people would hit their head and would come to your office and tell you that they're not feeling well, that they're having problems, and you get all this sophisticated imaging scanning and everything looks normal. And many times, because many of these injuries even happen at work, the conclusion was that, well, maybe this is malingering. Nowadays, we have come to understand these conditions a little bit better. There's more research that's been growing, not only from the sports, but also from veterans that are coming back from the wars and all the effects that they're having from this apparently indolent or innocuous type of mechanisms for injury. And you can see that the effects are pretty significant.
What are some of the signs, Norberto, that you have a brain injury?
Well, there's multiple. Depends on the severity of the brain injury. It can go anywhere from some irritability to trouble sleeping or low performance, changes in your cognition, maybe not doing so well at work. We do see a lot in the college athletes or young university students where they drop on their scores. So the symptoms could be multiple, and sometimes they're subtle, because you don't see them with a face droop or limping, and they look fine. And I always use the same expression that the container looks fine, but the contents are still a bit stirred.
So does the location of the injury determine how severe it is? Does that have any impact on severity?
Sometimes there are more there are areas of the brain that are eloquent to specific functions. You know, we know that well. However, I dislike the concept of saying, well, you hit your head, what function is affected? I think the whole brain is affected. And for the concussion, for example, if you use that as an example, well, you don't have any specific area of the brain that is hurt, but it's mostly the connecting fibers that suffer, what we call the wiring, the white matter.
Jed, how many people suffer from TBI? I mean, what's the frequency of this?
It's millions in the United States annually, and I think the latest statistics are some 200,000 are hospitalized each year due to traumatic brain injury, and of those, about 50,000 people annually will die as a result of brain injury. So it's not just something that causes some mild behavioral or cognitive dysfunction in the case of mild traumatic brain injury or concussions, but it's also very severe. I mean, this is a life-threatening emergency condition in a lot of situations.
How many of the people who suffer from this are children?
Well, that's a difficult question because, you know, many of these injuries go unreported. And there's more. There's been an increase in the consults to the emergency room because of all the awareness that's going on. I think that all this NFL press that we've been having has increased that. And for what I mean, we don't I don't treat children, but for what I understand, the visits to the ER has increased about 20%.
Absolutely. Children are not immune from this. Neither are infants. I mean, there's the shaken baby syndrome, which is brain damage from, you know, violently shaking an infant. But the most the peak demographics for traumatic brain injury, there's kind of two of them. One's in the young adults, maybe age 18 to 30. And it tends to be more prevalent in males than females, about 2-to-1, because men tend to engage in more high-risk behaviors. So there's the young demographic, and then there's an older demographic as well in the elderly, where we see a lot of traumatic brain injuries from falls.
What happens with children who have TBI? Do they bounce back quicker because they're kids, or is this still?
No, not necessarily. Actually, there's the thought that there's a specific period through a child where they'd be more vulnerable to head injury because the brain is not completely developed; it's still in formation. Actually, there's some very radical calls about not allowing children to engage in contact sports sometimes, or there's somebody who even proposes to people should not engage into contact sports until their brain is fully formed or they're early adults. This is as hard as it goes.
Now, what are the leading causes of TBI? I mean, you have concussions in sports, you have things like that, that people are, I think, a little more aware of, but what are the causes?
Falls.
Is that the biggest thing?
Well, if you look at numbers in general population, yes. If you look at the number one cause is falls. I mean, you need to consider we have an aging population. And if you look at the statistics, 70% of people above 70 who have fallen once will fall again within the year. And as we were mentioning, when you add to the mix that sometimes all these people are taking blood pressure medications or blood thinners that may affect the severity of the injury, or they may affect the changes in the blood pressure that may lead them to have falls, that explains itself.
And close behind that is motor vehicle accidents, as far as the severe end of the spectrum. And I think that brings up another important point about traumatic brain injury is it's one of the most preventable forms of neurologic disease. You can safeguard your home, make sure the bathroom and the stairs and everything are safe with handrails and non-slip surfaces and that kind of thing, and wearing a seatbelt, wearing a helmet if you're a motorcyclist, or wearing a helmet if you're a bicyclist. So I think that's an important point. There's something we can do about it, and these preventative measures and awareness of the possibility of head injury has decreased the number that have occurred in the United States over the past decade or so.
So use some common sense and protect your head.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, we were talking about concussions. Is there a cumulative effect, say an athlete who suffers multiple concussions or head trauma, is this something that just...
There seems to be. We know little. We're beginning to unravel a little bit this puzzle. And that ties into that whole topic of the chronic traumatic encephalopathy. There seems to be a cumulative effect.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. You can also email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Jed, do we have any idea what kind of effect this has on the impact this has on the economy? I mean, I imagine it's expensive to treat traumatic brain injury.
And so Norberto, the last numbers that I looked at, $60 billion, enough money to build a new international space station.
$60 billion,
yeah.
Correctly. That's amazing. So this is an expensive thing to treat, and prevention, I guess, would be the best way to deal with that.
And authorities Absolutely. Are taking notes, so I think that's where they've been funding research, and particularly the military has been very active. They've been spending a lot of money in trying to promote all these studies, some of them very innovative. To try to prevent the effects of head injury.
Now, how much more likely does TBI make it that you're going to develop other health problems?
Well, there's a link. Actually, an investigator out of here in Cincinnati that works also with the Department of Veterans Affairs was the first to to discover or establish this link between TBI and PTSD. There seems to be the coexistence in 20 to 25% of people between TBI and PTSD.
So are things like epilepsy and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's also something that you might develop because of this?
Absolutely. And the pathology of what's termed chronic traumatic encephalopathy, this is the type of brain injury that that's been reported in these deceased NFL players. That's something that's found in a lot of other neurodegenerative psychiatric diseases, and there's a lot of overlapping pathology. And I think that's one of the important questions going forward: is to what extent are the changes that we see in these in the brains of people who've suffered these concussions or played professional sports? To what extent are those changes due simply to the concussions, or are the concussions accelerating a baseline or adding to a baseline risk that they already have for other neuropsychiatric diseases?
Yeah, this is not a new concept, this chronic traumatic encephalopathy. This was described earlier in the past century as a punch drunk syndrome, where there was a pathologist in LA that studied the brains of this famous, you know, when boxing was more popular. And he studied the brains of these boxers, and he found a number of abnormalities that were revisited now in Boston University, where they have a bank of brains where they're studying all this chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and it's exactly the same.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us to discuss traumatic brain injuries are University of Cincinnati Division of Neurotrauma Director and Department of Neurosurgery Associate Professor Dr. Norberto Andaluz and UC Department of Neurosurgery Research Associate Professor Dr. Jed Hardings. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jed, you've been involved in research on something that's known as spreading depolarizations. Now, what are these, and what part do they play in traumatic brain injury?
Well, spreading depolarizations is it's a complex term. We like to call them brain tsunamis sometimes, to maybe make it easier to think about. But essentially, the brain functions in a living, healthy person by generating electrical signals. And like anything else, to generate electrical signals, you have to have stored electrochemical energy, or essentially batteries. So all of your brain cells essentially have batteries to generate this activity. And what happens during a brain tsunami is that there's a draining of the battery so that it's essentially down to 0 volts. And if the battery's drained, that means the brain stops functioning. And what happens is that once this starts in one place in the brain, it will spread throughout the brain.
And that's why the analogy to a tsunami then.
Exactly. Okay. And the other aspect of the analogy is that a brain tsunami in a healthy person isn't ultimately damaging. For instance, these can occur in patients that have migraine headache. And when that happens, patients will experience creeping neurological symptoms like tingling in their arm or their face, or maybe a blackout in their visual field. But ultimately, those are not damaging to the brain. Just like a tsunami, when it's out in the ocean, doesn't cause any damage. But if the brain's vulnerable because it's already experienced an injury like a trauma or a stroke, and then these brain tsunamis occur on top of that, then they can wreak devastation in the same way that a tsunami propagating through the ocean finally causes devastation when it crashes to shore.
So by looking at brain tsunamis, are these going to give you clues on how you can treat traumatic brain injury?
Absolutely. And it's such an exciting breakthrough, because never before in any kind of brain injury, from stroke or from trauma, have we been able clinically to measure pathologic processes and diagnose ongoing pathologic processes in patients in real time as a basis for altering our treatment. And now in the past 10 years or so, we've learned how to do that reliably and can now begin to use this in managing patients. And at this point, we're talking about the very severely traumatic brain injured patients who are being cared for in the intensive care unit.
And when you think of the importance of this, for me, the surgeon, the one who treats the living patient with a severe head injury, who's comatose on a ventilator, I cannot examine this patient other than, you know, waking him up from the anesthetic, or sometimes it cannot be done because of the severity of the condition. So I really don't know what's going on with this person. And having this information in real time, in combination with other elements that we look, like brain oxygenation, pressure inside your head, measuring electrical activity, that's invaluable. This is like putting the stethoscope on the brain.
Wow. Can you actually hear these, or how do you track them?
We make recordings. They're very similar to EEG recordings, and we can see them moving across the screen in real time.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Tim in Hillsboro. Good afternoon, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, thank you.
I fell off a roof in 2008 and have suffered from a variety of cognitive and whatnot functions, you know, memory, concentration, et cetera, et cetera. And the first couple of years, though, I was misdiagnosed with like a attention deficit disorder and insomnia and all these other diagnoses. Is that kind of common in these traumatic brain injuries?
Yes, it is. Yes, it's common to see the symptoms that you're mentioning that go anywhere from your sleep rhythm, your concentration, even your performance at work. All these things can be affected as a result of a head injury.
And what are some other signs you should look for? And is this a case where if you have a blow to the head, you should automatically go to the doctor and say, hey, this happened to me? And
well, it's always good to make sure that everything is fine. As you know, the big majority of the injuries are what we call mild head injuries. I mean, we have a very perverse system of calling our head injuries from mild, minor, moderate, and severe.
I think like we were saying earlier, even something mild can cause you a lot of problems.
Yeah, they're all bad. This is like having a benign tumor in the brain. Well, it's benign, but it's in your head. So, yes, there's many of your domains in your function that can be affected, from your mood, your intellect, affect. We see some dramatic changes on people after having had head injuries.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us. You can also email talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Joe in Northern Kentucky. Good afternoon, Joe. You're on the air.
Yeah. How do you find out if you have a minor brain injury? If you can't, if MRI doesn't pick it up, what does?
I didn't understand the question. What picks up?
He's wondering if an MRI can't pick up the damage, doesn't see damage. How do you know if you have a minor?
Well, actually, it will help you determine that you haven't had anything severe. It's the other way around. It's mostly the history, the mechanism of the injury, and your symptoms. If you have had loss of consciousness, if you have had any neurologic deficit, if you're having any symptoms, a lot of it goes with believing what the patient is telling you.
What are all the tests that someone would go through if the doctor suspects they've had a...
There are a number of cognitive tests, which are maybe a little bit exhaustive. They check a number of different functions of the brain. They're more elaborate. We usually don't like to do them, or the people who work with us in the rehab aspects don't like to do them right away, because they may be altered, because, you know, you may be taking pain medication, you may still be hurting. But there are a number of other objective things that you can see, like your visual coordination. Actually, we do have pretty significant research here in Cincinnati about the visual pathways, how they can be affected, that may be evident at the time of a concussion.
Again, 513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Laura in Hyde Park. Hi, Laura.
Yes, hi.
Go right ahead.
Yeah. 8 years ago, I had a brain tumor that was very large, and they had to remove my right parietal lobe. And I was wondering, is that considered a brain injury, or is that just a surgery?
Okay.
Well, a surgery is an injury. It's a trauma to the body, and you can take this from a surgeon. Yes, every time there's this sanctuary that you have in your head that's been violated, either by a trauma or by surgical means, certainly there's an impact to the brain. And yes, the brain suffers. Of course, it looks like you have had a wonderful outcome listening to you speak in the radio. But yes, it's a trauma in a way.
Now, what's the process of treating traumatic brain injuries?
Well, it depends on how severe
right,
it
whether
is.
Whether it's mild or moderate.
The most severe, which is what I usually have to spend the most time with, this depends. It depends. Some of these injuries have some focus of hemorrhage, whereby we have to make openings in the head and drain blood, or maybe sometimes with the swelling, there's very significant increase of the pressure in the head. You would figure that the skull is a closed container and the brain can swell significantly, so there's pressure there. And we know that pressure affects your blood flow and your oxygen delivery. So many of the things that we do is open that container. We open that compartment, so we remove pieces of the skull. Famous example, this legislator that got shot in the head from Texas, Gifford?
Gabby Gifford,
yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that allows for you to contemporize for, you know, the part of the swelling that's for the first few days until everything settles down. That allows to protect the brain and protect that secondary injury that occurs.
But other than doing surgery and removing a clot or a blood clot or decompressing the skull in order to allow for swelling, there's really not much that we can do specifically for the brain. Most of the therapy for the severe injury is focused around making sure that the patient is adequately oxygenated and the heart's working and the lungs are working properly. But we still don't, unlike other diseases, we don't have any drugs or treatments that specifically target protecting brain cells. And that's really been the holy grail of the field of traumatic brain injury research for the past decades. And that's the reason we're so excited about this trial that is upcoming, that we're going to be starting here at the University of Cincinnati together with five other centers throughout the United States and also some cities in Japan. That's going to examine the effects of hypothermia, early induced hypothermia, or cooling the patient in order to protect the brain when it's in this vulnerable period in the initial days after a severe head injury. And hypothermia is something, it's not novel, it's been studied for a long time. But what's really novel about this trial is that we're going to be targeting a specific subtype of traumatic brain injury. Because one of the things that we've realized in more recently is that not all traumatic brain injuries are the same. There are a lot of different components of brain tissue and vasculature that can get injured differently in different types of patients. And this might be seem obvious that, you know, cancer, for instance, they're not all cancer is the same. You've got to treat them differently. And so for the first time in the trial that we're planning with hypothermia, we're going to target a specific subtype of the traumatic brain injury that involves a bleeding that can occur. It's called a subdural hematoma between the brain and the skull, and that compresses on the brain and can cause injury.
And if I understand this in layman's terms, that would be blood clots on the brain caused
exactly.
by external trauma.
Correct.
Are you just looking at external trauma, or is there any thought that this could help people who've suffered brain injury from something else, say they've had a stroke that caused the injury?
Well, this particular study is dedicated only for trauma. And in going back to Jet's speech. This has been studied before, and I think it has not well studied before. This has been too broad. This is like treating all kinds of cancer with one chemotherapy kind of agent, or all infections with only one antibiotic. So I think that the smart thing that they have done about this study is try to identify the people that have shown to have some benefit from the hypothermia at the time of their injury in that big study, and they have been very, very selective. So this is the one where we're pretty sure that it's going to work with, but we just need to prove the world.
When you're talking about hypothermia, I mean, how cool are you talking about? What body temperature constitutes hypothermia?
Well, we call that this is moderate hypothermia, so it's only 33 degrees Celsius,
which is about 91 degrees Fahrenheit.
And that can actually have some beneficial effects on somebody who suffered this.
Absolutely, and it's shown benefit in other types of brain injuries, such as you might suffer after cardiac arrest, where blood flow to the brain is decreased for some period of time. Immediate or very early induction of hypothermia can improve survival and recovery from that. So we want to apply that to the same principles to this particular subtype of traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, we've all heard the stories of somebody who drowns in the lake, in the frozen lake.
Falls to the ice, yeah.
Exactly.
Right. That's hypothermia for you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're looking for public comment on this study right now. Now, why the need for public comment?
Exactly. The need for that arises from the fact that that this is an emergency study. It's an emergency treatment of patients who are unconscious. And because any time a human subject participates in research, it's voluntary. There has to be informed consent to participate in the study. But someone with a severe brain trauma and who needs emergent treatment isn't going to be capable of providing that consent. And since it's an emergency procedure, we can't even ask the family members whether or not they would want their loved one to participate in a study. So in this very special case, it's very important for us to go out to the community and tell them that we're going to be doing this study or that we intend to, and ask about their opinion and get their feedback to know whether or not it's something that the community would want to be involved in. And if there's sufficient approval and understanding and acceptance of the study, then we may be given permission to proceed with it in a manner in which we would enroll patients in cases where we can't find their family members and the patients themselves aren't able to give consent.
How do people weigh in on the study? How can they do that?
In terms of this process,
right?
You know, what usually happens is, and this happens to me because I'm the surgeon. Usually, patients come in a very bad condition. They come with air care or through an ambulance, and they're comatose, and they get diagnosed with a CAT scan that they have a subdural hematoma, and I have to take them to the surgery suite emergently. Really, there's no time for much. Many times patients go to the operating room in an emergency basis even without a surgical consent. So as part of this study, we would like to see if the community would feel that it's appropriate for us to start the treatment the same way that we're doing the life-saving procedure, to start the cooling process without the specific written permission. This is something that you can essentially opt out if your husband comes in or your loved one comes and says, well, you know, I don't want my loved one to be part of this study, please turn off the cooling device. It will not affect the way that you get treated normally for your condition. Still an emergency, you get the same treatment like everybody else. This is just a plus.
Right. And we are looking for feedback from the community, and people that want to learn more can contact clinicaltrials@mayfieldclinic.com or call 513-558-3546 to learn more about the study. And hopefully, if they're interested, they can fill out a short survey. It's just 3 or 4 questions and submit it to us so we can learn what your opinion is.
Yeah, you know, ultimately, last question for you. How much is the brain capable of repairing itself over time?
Well, it is surprising. It's not so much repairing itself, but compensating for deficits. And it is fascinating, and it's one of the most rewarding things that I see. Sometimes, actually, today I received a Christmas card from a patient that was hopeless, devastated. And this young man somehow, with some difficulties, he managed to finish school. He now has a job, and we get every year his Christmas card.
That's the best.
That has to make you feel very good. Well, thank you both for being here this afternoon.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you so much for having us.
University of Cincinnati Division of Neurotrauma Director and Department of Neurosurgery Associate Professor Dr. Norberto Andaluz and UC Department of Neurosurgery Research Associate Professor Dr. Jed Hardings. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.